Welcome along to part two.
The only time the three surviving Beatles ever played together was at Eric Clapton's wedding. And I did a book about Lonnie Donegan a couple of years ago, and Lonnie wormed his way into the wedding reception. And there is a great picture of Paul, George and Ringo with Lonnie, which the photographer allowed me to use on the back of my book. And it was Jonathan Clyde who worked with George and now runs Apple. And I said, what are your memories of this historic event? I mean, it was 1979. Mick got up to sing with Paul, George and Ringo. Lonnie got up to sing with Paul, George and Ringo, uninvited. But they came to this, they had this really good idea afterwards, but John was in New York, and the first record John then ever bought with his own money was Lost John by Lonnie Donegan. So Paul, George and Ringo said, what you do is we'll get Lonnie on Concord, and he goes to New York, and he'll get John, and we'll all get together again. And it was a great idea. It never came in. And I said to Jonathan Clyde, so I mean, this historic moment, you know, the three surviving Beatles, Mick Jagger on vocals, Lonnie Donegan on vocals, you know, what can you remember about the event or whatever? And he said, not a lot. He said, I mean, Eric's a very generous host, you know, we're also peers, so you remember. You know, so all us rock historians are, you know, pens poised waiting for the set list. But there was nobody can remember.
Eric was always a gentleman, wasn't he? I know he had all of the problems he had in life, whatever, but to me, one of the artists that I met that was my great hero, I had the privilege, and ironically, the record company put him up in a really dreadful hotel in Queensway. But I took out for dinner Muddy Waters, and I thought, I want to ask one question and one question only. Tell me about slavery. Tell me your experience. Which he did for about best part of 3 hours. Wow. And it was, you know, on a personal level, absolutely fascinating. But then he said, look, well, there's a band, I want to go to Dingwalls. Do you mind if we go? I said, no, it's fine. So we go over there, we're sitting there and we're watching this band. And sure enough, Clapton comes over and says, you know, do you mind if I join you? And I said, who are you? And he said, I'm Eric Clapton. I went, sorry, I recognise you now.
Genuinely, you said, who are you?
Yeah, I did. I didn't know. Well, it was quite dark.
It would have to be very dark.
But he joined us, and I mean, what a gentleman.
Eric Clapton, Cream.
That's right.
Knock me on one. Knock your block on. Guys, I'm going to have to go home soon, because I've got my shopping bin delivered soon. So, one of my stories, I'm going to have to get my keys out. Yeah. Scott Walker has an album out called Climb Up the Hunter. So I said to Tessa at Virgin, I want to work with Scott Walker. Yes, okay, fine. When this album comes up, fine. So I get to his flat in Chiswick, and he's got a sign on it. Do not ring this doorbell before midday, wouldn't it be answered? Knock on the door. Hi, Scott, how about you? Yeah, hi, Ben. Hi. So I said, Scott, I've got to tell you something. I was told not to talk to you by the record company. Oh, really? Oh, right, man. I said, can I just say to you that your work with Jacques Brel is brilliant? He looks at me and goes, what did you say? I said, oh, sorry. He said, no, what did you say? I said, your work with Jacques Brel is brilliant. Oh, man, you've heard of Jacques Brel? I said, yeah, fantastic. So we get to do an interview with Radio 1, the Newsweek. And he's sitting there like this, and he's got his keys in his hands. He's going, I'm going to have to do this for the thing. He's going, Howard, man. Howard, could we, Howard, do you think we could, I'm saying, Scott, please, the keys on the microphone. Oh, yeah, man, yeah. Howard, could you ask the guy there? I said, what, Scott? Could you turn the lights down? So he turns the lights down. So Scott's still filling his cage. And I never saw Scott after that. Amazing meeting him. But what a nervous, fucked up guy he was.
The Stranglers played at the Marquee, you know, whatever it was, in the late 70s. Yeah. I think they may have been supporting. I did a Steve LeMack show last year, and we're recalling this, and Jet Black, one of the others.
Yeah.
No, it was Jean-Jacques, he remembered this incident, that they played their set, and right at the end of the set, he put his bass guitar through the DJ box window. If you remember the marquee, there was a little DJ box with Jerry Floyd and all those guys used to sit there DJing. And he put the whole guitar through the window. Oh. And of course, at the end of the night, when they came down to, it was Sean Jack came down to collect the money, and I said, "Fuck off, mate! You know, get all your gear out.
Go,
I'll be deducting a load of money out of your money, which wouldn't have been a lot anyway." And this will be the last time you ever play the marquee. And this is right at the beginning of their career. I wasn't aware he was a black belt karate expert. Or anyway, that aside, anyway, he, with the tail between his legs, they went up, they got all their gear out, took it out the back door, then he came back down and I deducted whatever it was back in those days to repair the window. He said it wasn't his bass guitar, it might have been an amp that he put through the window. But he did remember that. And that was the last thing. They never played at the marquee again.
Brilliant. Punk rock, eh?
Those silly old punk rockers, eh?
So I think it was 1976. 1976, we're looking after the Four Tops, and I think we were doing a variety show called the Hippodrome or something, I don't know what it was. On the bill was Frank Carson.
The way I tell him.
The way I tell him. All Frank would ever do, you go in, did you hear one about... All Frank Carson ever did was tell jokes. And I'll never, ever forget Levi Stubbs and Abdul Fakur in the corridor coming towards the stage. Frank stops them and goes, "Do you hear the one about Hitler?" And the look on both their faces. And they just looked at him and then walked off. One of the funniest things.
You've just reminded me of a similar thing. We mentioned Lou Reed earlier. I did this charity celebrity auction thing. It was at Ronnie Scott's, bizarrely. It was a sort of celebrity karaoke event. And it was hosted by Bruce Forsyth. And they had incredible people there. People like Gwyneth Paltrow and David Gilmour and stuff. And it was like, who will bid £10,000 to hear Gwyneth Paltrow and David Gilmour sing Comfortably Numb? You know, it was that kind of thing. And all these incredibly rich people were flashing the money around. And they raised about £1.5 million just with the small amount of people that you could get into Ronnie Scott's. But Brucey was the host and I was the stage manager. And oddly, Lou Reed was there for some reason. Although it was celebrity karaoke, Lou didn't want to do another song. He wanted to do Walk on the Wild Side. So it was like, who'll bid, you know, however much money to hear Lou sing Walk on the Wild Side? Bruce, of course, has no idea who Lou Reed is. And to this day, I think, it's another claim to fame of mine, I think I'm the only man in history to have been on a stage at the same time as Bruce Forsyth and Lou Reed.
That's a good one.
The three of us were on the stage with Ronnie Scott's together. So I said to Bruce, I said, Lou Reed, who's he? I said, Lou is a very eminent guitarist, Velvet Underground, just say the legendary Lou Reed. All right, good player. I'll do that. I'll say that. Good, yeah, very good. I'll say the legendary Lou Reed. So Bruce is kind of introducing Lou. And Lou's guitar tech comes on stage to place the guitar on the stand. Bruce has no idea who Lou is. And Bruce thinks that the guitar tech is Lou Reed. So he goes, Lou Reed. And I'm going, Frank Carson.
My old friend Lou told me, I said, of all the appellations hurled your way, what's your favourite one? And the glasses came down the bin and he said, the Dark Prince of Rock and Roll, I kind of like, he said. And then the glasses went back up again. And he came into town a couple of days later to promote another unlistable album. And I was dispatched along. And looking back, one of the highlights of my professional career, actually, I went into this room and I extended my hand to Lou Reed, which of course he declined. And I said, oh, Lou, Patrick Humphries, you met a couple of years ago. He said, yes, sir. You were requested, he said. He actually asked for me to go back to the interview.
Wow,
I think that was seriously.
It's a high honour.
Yeah, it really was.
Even the fact that he moves his glasses.
Absolutely. Handshakes refused, we get used to that.
I've got another fleeting one. In another life, I lived in Hollywood for 8 years. I went there because they said the walk would do me good, but I shouldn't have. I was out in Hollywood as a failed actor. I married into the sort of Frank Zappa GTO sort of academy of wife. I married Jenny Lane's ex-wife, and she was like part of the Pamela de Bar sort of school of the plaster casts and all that stuff, if you know what I mean, of the groupie scene. I didn't know, but her name was Catherine. And a few people were saying to me, well...
you didn't know your wife's name.
Oh, I didn't know her, yeah, no. But I didn't know her as Miss Catherine. Because Miss Pamela was in the GTOs as Miss Pamela. I don't think Catherine was in the GTOs, but she's certainly been around a bit, if you know what I mean. One day she said, Tim's coming for tea. Now, I'm from Dartford, and I hadn't really met many people. All the heroes had been on my wall. So when she said it was Tiny Tim coming for tea, I was like, you've got to be joking. So Tiny Tim's coming for tea. And you really couldn't have written it. We're sitting there, 100 degree heat in the Hollywood Hills, and you hear this. Sure enough, coming up the drive, it's Tiny Tim. With a banjo, ukulele, and a brown bag. He comes in, greets Miss Catherine, as she's known now in Hollywood. I learned she's now Miss Catherine. And proceeds to bring out five bottles of Guinness. So all he drank was warm Guinness. And proceeded over the next 2 hours to go through the history of music on his ukulele. Literally, and I think there was some sort of world record of Tiny Tim doing this. And it goes right back to the start of music, right through to rock and roll. Oh, to give a white balls of fire. Oh. And there he is sitting on there. He finished, caked in white makeup. I forgot to tell you that. Drank his last Guinness and said, well, goodbye, everybody, goodbye. And he walked down the garden path, still singing until it just faded. Well, and that was one of the weirdest things I've ever seen in my whole fucking life.
Steve shares with me the opinion that Bob Dylan is the greatest man to ever do breath.
I'm sorry, Your Honour.
I've never got to interview Dylan. He brushed against me in 1987. This, you can't see it, unfortunately, but it was this shoulder. At a press conference at the National Film Theatre for this dreadful film he did called Hearts of Fire. But it's a Guinness that reminded me. Bob Dylan's television debut was for the BBC for a play called Madhouse on Castle Street, which was broadcast in January 63. So it was the winter of the Big Freeze. And he came over and stayed in London and did some shows unannounced. But he did the original basement tapes were done in the basement of Dobell's record shop on Charing Cross Road. And it was Bob Dylan, Richard Farina, a great singer-songwriter, Rick von Schmidt and a guy called Ethan Signer, who's a violinist, and they had a session down there. I did a radio program about that trip, Dylan's first trip to the UK, and Bob Dylan wouldn't talk. Rick von Schmidt was dead. Richard Farina said the only person we could get was Ethan Signer, this violinist. So we got him at great expense, BBC studio in London, tracked him down to New York. So we had an hour booked. So, Ethan, hi. Patrick Humphries in London. Just to talk about that session you had with Dylan back in London in 62, 63. I expect you got some great memories of that session to remember. Yes. And you would have been familiar with Dylan's work. And you're going, oh, Christ, there's another 57 minutes to go. We couldn't. The only thing we got out of it was, when you meet him, don't offer Bob Dylan bottled Guinness. He hates it. They had a crate of bottled Guinness in the cellar. They took the top off. Dylan took a long swig of bottled Guinness. But said, what is this shit? So when you next meet him, don't buy Bob Guinness. Bob Guinness?
Bob Guinness. Bob Guinness.
A pint of Dylan, please.
A pint of Dylan. You'll find this Dylan.
Yeah. Talking of drinking, when I used to look after the artists, the Americans, when they came in, they would inevitably like to go for a drink. And I would say, fine, but in those days the pubs were closed. Because by the time they'd come through on an early morning flight from across the pond, it would be around 2-ish, the pubs were closed. There was nowhere to go. So we eventually all gravitated to this club called the Capricorn Club in Goodge Street, which is very famous for certain people. And it was completely sleazy, but an amazing sort of atmosphere. And lots and lots of the acts that I used to look after, we'd go there. But one day in particular, I was looking after Frank Zappa. He said, I want to go for a drink. I said, fine. I'm guessing not in the hotel bar. He said, no, definitely not. Take me somewhere interesting. So I thought, well, this guy's got to be. It's got to be. And I mean, to say this place was unusual, and by record company terms, there was a phrase called the quarter to four. And the quarter to four was a stripper that came on at quarter to four. She was Larry Grayson's secretary in Are You Being Served? On television.
No,
she was the quarter to four stripper. And she was quite famous by from all the record companies. You would just ring each other up and go, quarter to four. Okay. So anyway, so I took Frank there, and he just, well, he loved it. He absolutely loved it. And I had the most amazing conversation with him. Really sensible, obviously articulate. But we finished all of that, and then I said, look, you've got to come back to the record company now, because Obi and all the heads want to meet you and all that sort of stuff. He said, fine. And we carried on chatting. And as soon as we got to the door of the office, of head office in Soho Square as it was then, he said, you must excuse me, it's time for me to be Frank Zappa. And everything changed in that second, in that heartbeat. The ease of conversation became incredibly difficult, and he became Frank Zappa, not this lovely, lovely guy who I was drinking with all afternoon.
I think that's fascinating. Is there any truth in the rumour that the Keith Richards we see is Keith Richards, or does he become Keith? I mean, you know, the image of Keith we have is Iron Man, you know, the skull ring and the slurred speech. A colleague of mine was at an awards ceremony having, as you say, a similar chat, and then suddenly the award was announced for his autobiography, and he became Keith. You know, I mean, is there that?
I'm sure with artists who are famous for being enigmatic, they probably do have this mask that they put on, and behind closed doors with people they trust and know really well, they are far more relaxed and normal. If their whole image is this of someone mysterious and, I mean, nowadays with social media, you hardly know, there's nothing, no stone unturned with most artists. So you know what they're thinking, breathing. But in the good old days, before we had all that, artists were mysterious. And I guess, yes, that just like Dave said, with, you know, Frank Zappa, the persona goes on.
But I think that's one of the reasons why Dylan is so popular forever, because it's not just grey-haired people like me, but I mean, young people are fascinated by, because he is this enigma, and I think it's a very good point. With social media, you know everything about everybody before they do, and Dylan never sits down, he doesn't turn up on Graham Norton saying, well, hey, yeah, funny, Mr. Tambourine Man, Mr. Baba. He never explains anything, and when he does do interviews, they're quite elliptical, and I think he's one of the few people who maintains an air of mystery, which I think perpetrates the myth. And here's something that's going to make you feel really old. In 2021, Bob Dylan will be 80.
I just remembered, I don't know if you know this story, it's not my story, Andy Kershaw tells this story, the wonderful story about Bob Dylan and going to Dave Stewart's studio in Stoke Newington. Do you know this one? Dave Stewart from, you know, Eurythmics had this, the recording, the Church Studios in Stoke Newington, and was working with Dylan, was going to produce the Dylan album. So Dylan just shows up. I think Dave just said, oh, come around to the studio, we'll just sort of work out some tracks.
Yeah, Dave used to do that a lot.
And so Dylan just showed up. I don't know whether he you know, got a bus or what have you, but Dave obviously gave him the address. Dylan shows up in Stoke Newington, gets the address wrong, knocks on a door which he thinks is Church Studios, and it's just some guy's house.
Well, it's Dave the Plumber's house.
It's Dave the Plumber's
house. This is what confuses me.
Who is a massive Bob Dylan fan.
But Dave the Plumber's out there.
He's out.
So Dave the Plumber's wife says, oh, come on in.
Yeah, she assumes. Because Dylan goes, hey, is Dave there? And the wife of Dave the Plumber said, no, Dave's out, but come in and wait for him. Dylan walks into the front room, sits down there, surrounded by thousands of Bob Dylan albums, because the guy's a massive Dylan fan. The wife makes him a cup of tea. He waits for like half an hour. Then it's obvious that Dave the Plumber isn't coming back.
Well, actually, if David said Stoke Newington, that's probably why Bob got the wrong address, because it was Crouch End.
I mean to say Crouch End.
David Hepworth, when there was a big debate who was going on the cover of the first Q magazine, it ended up being McCartney. They'd done the Dylan interview and Sony were a bit cheesed off, but David Hepworth was interviewing Dylan at Madison Square Garden in 87 or whatever, and went off to get a cup of coffee, a cigarette, and he came back, and the roadie said to Dylan, so how's the interview going? He said, well, it's okay, but he just keeps asking me questions.
But I think that story ended that. I think Bob obviously realised that he'd got the wrong place and sort of excuses himself. And then Dave the plumber came back. Can you imagine the conversation between them? Oh, by the way, Bob Dylan was here to see you and you missed it.
Jesus.
That's funny.
I mean, talking of Dave Stewart, because I've worked with him for 2 or 3 years, running Anxious Records, which, as I said earlier, was lived up to its name. But there was a pub just across the road from the office and the studios, and I think it's the King's Arms in Crouch End. And anyone who was
that'll
in
be
town,
Crouch End.
Dave would say, "Hey, you know, come on down. We're having a jam, you know." And there was one night in there which I wish we'd had a desk at the back and we'd recorded it. Bonnie Raitt was in town, so she was on guitar. Dave on guitar, with a bunch of musicians who him and Annie used to take out on the road with them. And it was one of those sort of impromptu, any guests will do. And then Harry Dean Stanton walks through the door. And Dave says, hey, Harry, you must know a song. And he gets up on stage and goes, "I'm going to tell you how it's going to be." It is the best version of that song I have ever heard in my life. It would have been a number one single for 25 weeks. The laconic actor's take on the lyrics, I will never ever forget it. But I said to Dave afterwards, I said, "Next time you do that, we have to record it." Yeah, but he would probably never have let us release it. Anyway, I said, I wish I had a recording to listen to that again. It was just brilliant.
Dave Stewart, just before I made my quantum leap onto the screen, I moved up to Crouch End. That's my first flat in near Suicide Bridge, I think is what they're called there. And I very quickly then, because of Jeff Griffin, approached me at an Alice Cooper concert, Jeff Griffin from Radio 1, and said, "Would you like to do a concert on Radio 1? I said, "Yes," which totally went to my head. The fee was £40 back then for doing it. I think John Peel got it raised from 23 to 40. But I was very enamoured by myself about being on the radio. Now, Dave Stewart found out where I lived and would knock on the door a lot with a tape of this girl's voice, Annie. And I, in my stupid tomfoolery way, just sort of said, "So what?"
So this was the tourist? Was it?
Yeah.
Pre-tourist.
Yeah.
So how was the career in A&R after that?
Yeah, exactly. Bad. And I was not very nice. I really was not. I was right up my arse. And about 3 years later, Eurythmics won Band of the Year, I think it was. And there I was at the Grosvenor House for MTV interviewing Dave Stewart.
"I'm a false vegan, I'm a star."
Who proceeded
to... We've never met before.
Proceeded to give me shit. And rightly so.
I think, hey, Steve, what do you know?
Yeah, and right. And a year before that was Fergal Sharkey when I was interviewing. They were both repellent to me. But, I mean, rightly so, it just shows you just don't know who you're going to meet coming up and down.
No. When I first joined CBS, I had a little flat in West Hampstead. And I was fortunate enough, I'd been touring with Return to Forever, which, if you like jazz fusion, for me is the ultimate band. Chick Corea, yeah. Andy Meola, Stanley Clarke, yeah. Lenny White. I mean, amazing. Anyway, so we'd finished and... I mean, this is the days of tape recorders and old kit. And Chick said, "I really want to get a cable because I want to record something from this tape machine or another tape machine so I can do this. It's not a studio thing, it's just a home thing." I said, "Well, okay, we could sort that out." He said, "Well, where do you live?" I said, "I told him West Ham." He said, "Well, I'll come around Saturday." I mean, it was literally just a local thing. So he popped round and I thought, "Oh, this is sweet." And there was one of those hi-fi shops in West Hampstead, and it was like not the 9 o'clock news sketch where they are so... buffed up, these guys, they know everything about hi-fi. So we go in and Chick says, "Hello, I wonder if you can help me." He said, "I'm looking for a Canon connector." Going, no, not a Canon connector. He said, "That'll be if you're working on a stage, you'd need that." He said, "No, what you need is this cable." And Chick's going along with a guy. The guy is so unbelievably arrogant. And he's basically saying, "Well, if you do, well, no, I wouldn't connect it like that. I'd connect it like this." You know? So finally we get what we want. And then as we go to the, he said, "Can I pay by card?" He said, "Oh, yeah, of course." So, of course, Chick gives the guy the credit card. And in those days, you hand swiped it. And as he swiped it, he could see him going, "Chick, whoops, oh, well, I've got this wrong. And we just laughed our heads off because the guy was so full on about it. You know, if only you knew anything about stage stuff, you'd know.
Credit cards. Tom McGuinness of Manfred Mann and McGuinness Flint, when he left Manfred Mann and they formed McGuinness Flint, they rehearsed in Blackheath, which is where a lot of them live. And Capitol Records got to hear about them. And they wanted them to be the English equivalent of the band. So apparently they were offering huge sums of money for McGuinness Flint to sign to Capitol Records. So they sent the top people from LA over to Blackheath to rehearsal, and they agreed this could actually work. So the celebration lunch to commemorate McGuinness Flint signing to Capitol Records took place in their local pub. And of course the guy from LA said, whatever you want, you know, it's on Capitol Records. And so they ordered perhaps 2 pints of beer, who can tell? But the credit card came out to pay for it. And of course, the landlord of the pub in Blackheath in 1970 is going, what's that? It's you know, the guy from LA, it's a credit card. So I think the band actually ended up paying for their own launch.
My credit card story would go back to the Alan Parsons of the Alan Parsons Project, probably one of the most anonymous people in rock. Because
uncredited producer of Dark Side of the Moon.
Absolutely. And also, well, credited for music, of course. Yeah. But yeah, you're right. But anonymous. He was in LA, and Alan went to... the best of the Alan Parsons Project had come out. And as Alan was a lovely guy, still, you know, a gentle guy, he hadn't wanted to get any promo copies. So he went into Tower Records on Sunset and bought 30 of the album. Huh. He went up to pay for it, bought the credit card out with Alan Parsons on it, and the guy said, have you any other form of ID?
Well, there's that story about Nina Simone, wasn't there, when she was, I think it was in London, she was here, and she went into HMV on Oxford Street, and she went to all her CDs in the rack, and she picked them out. And she walked out the store with them, and obviously the alarms went, and the security guys leaped on her. And she said, what do you mean, these are my records? Said, well, you can't just, well, no, I'm not paying for them, they're mine. And there was this massive argument, you know how sort of fractious she used to get. And
yeah.
Well, she couldn't get that why she couldn't walk out with her own CD.
Well, we're all sitting here in Soho. Back in the days in Mead Street, which is now the kitchen, I think, of the Soho townhouse, there was a club called Gossips. I was in CBS in those days. I just did about 6 dates with the Jacksons for the Victory Tour, and I went to my boss and I said, we really should do something because, you know, they're an amazing act. And they said, well, they're not really, because they've kind of had their day, haven't they? They've had their hits. So no was the answer to that. So they wouldn't give me any budget whatsoever to do an after party or anything, and they were playing Hammersmith only. So I knew the guy who owned Gossips, and I said, look, you know, the band don't drink. Just put me on a buffet, just a simple buffet, and then that's all it's going to cost you. He said, well, dude, that's fine. So we ended up having an astonishingly good party. No one from the record company hardly turned up, because nobody really was told about it, because obviously it wasn't official. Didn't cost anyone a penny when it came to drinks, because of course the band didn't drink. So, and I was in the townhouse the other day doing a podcast here with John, and the guy found the original black and white pictures of the Jacksons in the cellar. He couldn't believe that there was a party there because the kitchen is tiny. But the fact that everybody was there, it's gone now. But part of Soho's nostalgia.
But they were the parties, the album launches were very important, weren't they? I'm sure you had them at the Marquee, and they were very ostentatious, some of them. And I remember the last Tango in the Night one at Hyde Park, Holland Park. From Warners, that was Fleetwood Mac, and they all came. This is actually going back to a plugging story, but the late great Bill Fowler, who sadly passed away, Foxy Fowler, the head of Warners PR, and you want it? I'll fix it. You're right, son. Yeah, lovely. At the time of the party in Holland Park, I was there, and Bill was parading me around as a bloke on the telly because I was doing breakfast time TV, and you know, and my producer and I. If we liked something as our hit pick or whatever you called it, you know, to 2.5 million people, it meant something. So Bill was plugging the hell out of me at this gig. Next morning in the office, I get a call, The producer says, "Oh, it's your cousin on the phone, Bill Fowler." So Bill says, "Bill," he says, "you enjoy the party last night? Lovely, loves a drink and all that food. Lovely, lovely." He said, "Come on, Cuz." He said, "Call Cuz, put the new single as your pick of the day on Monday." I said, "All right." He said, "The video." He said, he went on and on. I said, "Bill, look, give it a rest. Give it a rest." And as we know, people in the business know Bill, he would never give up. And he went on, he said, the video. He said, "Oh, it's fantastic. It's got Stevie in it and mix this and that." Went on for about 20 minutes. I said, all right. "Bill, we'll put it on. What's it called?" He said, "I don't fucking know. Just put it on."
I thought it's the HMV story, the Nina Simone. Long been fascinated by the Beatles, the bit players in the Beatles story. And Brian, they did the Decca audition, famous in New Year's Day 1962, and they were terrible. When it came out on bootleg years later, everyone said, how could anybody have turned the Beatles down? You hear the audition, it's more Burn the Cribbins than anything. But Brian, they had this reel-to-reel tape. Brian Epstein had this reel-to-reel tape. And you know, by the time he went in to try and interest record companies, you know, he had to get the tape queued out. So what he had to do is get it pressed onto acetate, which HMV did on Oxford Street, just a few hundred yards from here. And he went up to the bit of HMV, the store on Oxford Street, sometime in 1962, and he got the tape queued up. And as it was playing, a guy called Jim Foy was the guy who was in charge of transferring the tape to the acetate. Because that would be a lot easier, you know, three or four songs on one acetate. Brian could then take it around to all the other record companies that hadn't quite got around to rejecting the Beatles. And Jim Foy said, "That's quite good, this, isn't it? You know, who are they?" "Oh, it's a group I manage called the Beatles." And he said, "Oh, I don't know." So he said, "No, they write their own songs." He said, "Oh, really? Oh, that's interesting." A mate of mine, EMI, runs the publishing division of EMI, they're always looking for new people. Why don't you? And that is the connection that took Brian Epstein from Oxford Street to Manchester Square. It's a guy called Jim Foy. Right? Raise their glasses to
Jim Foy. Thank you. Now, Nigel, are you departing?
I'm going to go, yeah.
Are you going to go live on or recording on air departure?
Well, you want me to make a bit of a fuss as I leave?
Yeah, I think we should.
So what's the best gig at the marquee?
Yeah, best
gig at the marquee would be... there's so many out there. The 25th anniversary shows were really good. The whole series of shows I put on that year. I think, you know, Genesis, The Police. I think AC/DC. When I first started at the Marquee in 75, and the whole music industry was pretty much in the doldrums, pretty much. All the big bands, they were, you know, there's a lot of glitter going on and all that, and they were all kind of stadium bands, your Led Zeppelins and your Bowies and all these sort of people. They'd all sort of taken off, but we're in a sort of a void at that point. And then the whole punk thing started, but just before punk was AC/DC. And if ever there was a kind of a crossover band between rock and punk, they kind of glued it together a bit. And that summer of 76, you may recall, was very, very hot. Very hot indeed. Yes. And every couple of weeks, Eddie and the Hot Rods would play. Then a couple of weeks later, AC/DC would play. So during the summer, they sort of grew to this sort of phenomenon that they both were. But we did have seats in the marquee at that point. As this whole thing took off, every week the seats would get passed out over the top of people and then out the back. And then obviously all the people that had passed out got passed out over the top, taken out the back as well. But it was a brilliant summer, and I'm really lucky that I was part of that particular moment at the Marquee. And the Marquee has a lot of history that the music industry recognises, but yeah, I was just lucky to be there.
Is it true, though, that the carpet from the Marquee, when they closed it, you kept it and it's actually in your lounge? I stuck to it once and it was two weeks to get out.
It was pretty foul, yeah. No, we changed it to a rubber one. It must have been about 77, 78, because it was
Remember the rubber bubbles.
So yeah, the rubber bubble thing that you see everywhere around the world now.
And you walk in and your feet would stick to the floor.
Yeah.
No disrespect to the cleaning
abilities.
Did you have cleaning people?
We did have cleaning people there, and they did a grand. Well, they did the best they could do.
Yeah.
It's interesting that none of us have mentioned the speakeasy.
Or Sam Rich Club. Yeah,
Sam Rich. Yeah, Sam Rich Club. Yeah. Absolutely.
The other thing was AC/DC. Yeah. I remember when they first started out, everyone was going, he's wearing a schoolboy's uniform.
Yeah.
Going back to your boy George. Oh my God, you know, I mean, and that was only, what, 6-7 years later?
Yeah.
And he was the standout because he's wearing
a
schoolboy
uniform. It was weird.
Not because he was playing the most awesome lead guitar. It's just...
Well, it was on a lead as well.
Short
and we had to run around, as that sort of developed as his stage thing, we had to run around after him because we had the lead. There was no radio mic or anything like that.
Absolutely.
And he was running around all the whole club with his guitar doing all this kind of stuff.
It's still the loudest gig I've ever been to. I saw AC/DC at Hammersmith Odeon, as it was, and I'd worked with various heavy metal bands over the years, where you see the kids down the front sticking their heads in the bin and all the rest of it. But AC/DC, Hammersmith Odeon, I can't tell you what year it was because I'm old and senile, but that was the loudest gig I've ever been to.
Chris Welsh from Melody Maker said the loudest gig he ever saw was when The Who launched Tommy. They played the entire Tommy album. They launched it at Ronnie Scott's, but the gear they were using was what they'd normally use for
a
stadium.
They bring down
tiny.
The whole bloody stage.
Yeah, it was.
It's not much bigger than here.
No, no. And can you imagine that? And if a day's... How was the album launched, Chris?
Yeah.
Sorry?
Yes.
Well, the last thing was... the only other thing, the massive faux pas that I made in about 79, 80, when I took over as general manager and booking the band, was I booked the band... And everyone was making a massive fuss about this band. And anyway, they went on stage and I stood there with my girlfriend at the time. So I'm going to go and have a look at this lot, you know. And they came on and I watched two or three songs. I said, oh, I can't see this lot making it. And then I went back to the bar and that band was U2.
Oh,
and
a lot of people thought the same.
Yeah,
the
and they
days.
Still do.
I certainly still do.
I know, you were on Facebook the other day saying something about it.
So what's the biggest mistake you've ever made? I mean, if you stuck with U2, maybe.
Well, I did stick with them. I did give them a whole series of gigs after that, but that was based on the agents and the managers of the record company saying...
So are there any other big howlers that we...
I've got a quick howl. I used to Split Enz were my just about
Kiwi,
my,
great
my
Kiwi
favorite band. Live band, and I was at Chrysalis plugging them. The Dysrhythmia, whatever.
Launched
album.
At the Marquee,
were they?
They launched at the Marquee. Yeah.
God, they were good. And I even in my spare time on a weekend, I pay money to go and see them around the UK. I was a devotee and part of the Friends of the Enz in Australia, which was a club run by a certain Nod, if you remember a certain Nod, God bless him.
Certain Nod.
Nod, yeah.
Nod.
Nod.
Oh my God.
Again, dear departed Nod. But anyway, so Split Enz, in 1983, I think it was, I can't think where I was. Must have been doing some telly or other, or mending television or something. And
looking somebody's blog on.
Yeah,
so people could see you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like, yeah. May I come and mend your television so you can see?
I'll be
you.
In it in a minute.
I'm a presenter.
Yeah.
Let me show you.
Here's some of my reviews. Tim Finn gets hold of me and says, Tim and Neil will take me for lunch because something's happening. It's sure it's 83.
In the days when they were talking.
Yeah. Tim says, I'm off for a deal at Virgin. And Neil says, I've got this new band. I said, well, that's great. Good. I said, what's it called? And he said, Crowded House. I think I spat the soup out at the time, thinking that is the stupidest fucking name I have ever heard in my life.
Yeah.
He gives me some demos of one I'm pretty sure was Don't Dream It's Over and some others off the first album. And of course, I took them home and thought it was shite. I dug them out about 2-3 years ago. And I know he was angling for me to manage the band and stuff. But of course, it's another one, so I've got my, you know, another complete and utter cock-up of thinking, stupid name, rubbish songs.
So is it even worse than Bruce Springsteen at Live Aid, was it?
Bruce Springsteen.
You've made a lot of mistakes.
James Stewart, yes, and that's...
We still don't know who you saw.
I don't know. I don't know if I was
Look
there.
At the list. Look at the list.
Probably we're going to rename this series of podcasts Rock Fail.
Rock Cock-up.
Rock Cock-up.
Let's all remember the big album of the year, though. Now that's why I call it unrecouped advance.
I think we should leave it there. You have been listening to Rock Tales, a Podicle production. Our thanks go to presenter Steve Blacknell and his guests Nigel Hutchins, David Beeching, Nick Carpenter, Patrick Humphreys, Howard Marks, and John Mays for their fascinating stories. There will be more. Watch out for the next exciting episode of Rock Tales. Thanks for listening.